I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Texas Republicans, under pressure from President Trump to protect the GOP's narrow House majority, have spearheaded a mid-decade congressional map overhaul to net 5 additional Republican seats for the 2026 midterms. The new map reduces minority voting power in the Texas congressional elections, and critics charge that it violates the Voting Rights Act and it's unconstitutional. Nevertheless, the new map passed along party lines and it waits for Governor Abbott to sign it into law. This has sparked California Democrats to redistrict their own state. This gerrymandering war is reshaping the nation's political terrain, and it could be a sign of a failing democracy. What are your questions and concerns about this race to the bottom in gerrymandering? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
TPR tells the stories of our city, our struggles and our triumphs. Leaving a legacy gift to Texas Public Radio helps keep those stories alive. Find out how to create your legacy at tpr.org/legacy.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Redistricting, usually it's a once-a-decade reshaping of political maps, but now it's turned into a mid-decade political arms race. In Texas, Republicans have just pushed through new congressional maps designed to cement their hold on power in Congress. Now, Democrats in California are responding with a bold proposal of their own. The stakes couldn't be higher. The balance of Congress in 2026 could hinge on all these new lines. To explain what is happening, we're joined by Sam Wong, director of the Electoral Innovation Lab, which has pioneered innovative ways to measure and analyze gerrymandering. And Dr. Wong, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me on today.
So before we start talking about California and Texas, I think we should start in North Carolina. I think that's kind of where it started, really. Do you think that?
Oh, North Carolina is not the only place where it started, but certainly North Carolina is one of the prime spots for the gerrymandering wars, not just this cycle, but 10 years ago and even before that. The story of North Carolina is long and sad. Where do we begin?
Well, we can begin in 2023. That's where they did there was a conservative Supreme Court that took over in North Carolina. They overturned some rulings that outlawed political gerrymandering, and then they went to town and they created Republican districts, enough of them that actually managed to give Republicans control in Congress, which is kind of what we're trying to do in Texas.
Yeah. So the thing is, the more districts a state has, the more chance there is for mischief. And as you said, in 2023, before that, there was a state Supreme Court in North Carolina that was willing to go where the U.S. Supreme Court wouldn't go. So North Carolina was the subject of a U.S. Supreme Court case, Rucho versus Common Cause. It looked like the Supreme Court federally might step in. They stepped back. Then a state Supreme Court in North Carolina stepped in, but that was temporary. And like you said, when conservatives took over the court, they just reopened the case that had already been decided, and they just went and I never really heard of such a thing, but the court itself decided to revisit the case and allowed the legislature to redraw the map. As you say, it was enough seats to have by itself swung the congressional control in that year. There are other gerrymanders around the country. I mean, I would say North Carolina was right at the top. The fair state of Texas already had a gerrymander in place, and so that was another few seats for Republicans. And then Democrats had a fence of their own in Illinois. And when that tug of war was all done, it was a little bit of an advantage nationally, and it was enough to matter in a very close congressional election, which is where we are now.
But it did seem like North Carolina really flew under the political radar for most news consumers. If you didn't live in North Carolina, you probably didn't hear this story.
Yeah, I think that's right. When you ask Carolinians, people in North Carolina, about redistricting, they seem to be pretty aware that it's a pretty big deal, and they understand that they get dealt out of power. The state legislature in North Carolina doesn't need the governor's signature to enact a congressional plan. Like many states, they get to draw their own legislative map. And so you have this spectacle of legislators drawing their own congressional and state legislative lines and kind of picking themselves up by their own bootstraps and just staying in power. And there's a few states that are like that. North Carolina is one. Wisconsin also has been the site of, let's call it the kind of the under the radar gerrymandering wars of the last 10 years. And you are absolutely right. Now, in the last month or so, suddenly this has all spilled into public view. And I think before it used to be just political nerds who cared about it and those of us who were very interested in the nuts and bolts of government. And now I would say with Texas and now California, the whole sad process is in plain view and it's on the front page of your newspaper.
Right. And the question is that going to make a difference? Will voters suddenly they hold their nose or be repelled by this process? You know, will they understand that they are being basically eliminated from the politics? It's all about map drawing.
That's a good question. You know, when people are asked in surveys how they feel about gerrymandering, solid majorities, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, everyone's against gerrymandering. But I think that it's just the kind of thing where it's just a dirty word and people didn't really stop to think about it. But now where as few as three seats changing hands in next year's 2026 elections being enough to change control of Congress with the spectacle of mid-decade redistricting, which is something that hardly ever happens, I think it's front and center. And I would say I'm cautiously optimistic because having it front and center puts it on voters' minds in a way that it hasn't been as much as I would like to see.
So gerrymandering, dirty word. How do you go from – how bad does it have to be just to have like a seat that is drawn to one party's advantage, just an aggressive redistricting to get to gerrymandering? Is gerrymandering – is it – have some sort of qualifications or it has to be even egregious?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is something that the U.S. Supreme Court stepped back from. They were clear about saying that partisan gerrymandering was unconstitutional, but then they said something that kind of made me tear my hair out, which is they said, okay, it's unconstitutional, but we do not find it something that we can judge. And the word they used was not justiciable, which is a fancy word for we're going to just not get our hands dirty. So speaking as a statistics nerd, it is absolutely possible to detect such things. What we can do at the Electoral Innovation Lab is look at maps, evaluate them, and through collaboration with the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, which sits at Princeton University, come up with standards for when a map has gone out of line, whether it's, as a statistician would say, whether a map is an outlier. And it's possible to look at all the alternatives and, well, not all the alternatives, it's possible to explore hundreds of thousands or even millions of alternatives and say, you know, the map that the legislators drew could not have arisen neutrally by chance. And it is so unlikely that it arose by chance that it seems there must have been some other motive. And then if you look in a state like North Carolina, where the map is, depending on before or after redistricting, 10-3 or 10-4 for Republicans, that's something that very rarely happens in a 50-50 state. And that statistical view of whether something's gotten to be an outlier is something that experts offer in court, nerds and math professors and scientists like me, we can identify these. And so it's possible to figure out when something has just gotten too far out of line.
We're going to take a break right here. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Are you fed up and done with all of this political gerrymandering? Would you like to see fair maps, some sort of system for drawing fair maps in Texas or across the country simultaneously, so one political party doesn't have the, you know, higher hand than the other, be able to outmaneuver the other, bring a gun to a knife fight, so to speak? What do you want to see happening? What questions do you have about what's happening in Texas and California? Where is this all going? Are you concerned that this is showing the unraveling of our democracy? Here's an opportunity to try and say no more. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and the source continues right after this break.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the race to the bottom with gerrymandering wars. Who loses? It's going to be the voters. We're speaking with Sam Wong. He's the director of the Electoral Innovation Lab. He's also the Princeton Gerrymandering Lab. He's also a neuroscientist. Maybe we'll get into some of the overlap with that. And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Chris. And Chris, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. It's a really interesting conversation and obviously relevant here in Texas. I'm a San Antonio resident. My question is, I remember 10 to 20 years ago, and I'm pretty calendar deficient as far as the memory goes, but somewhere along the lines at the federal level, I remember them having conversations to the tune of a federal oversight or federal actually doing the work of creating fair maps based on consensus once every decade. I don't know if I'm making that up or if that was a true thing, but I'd love to hear if there has been historically a push for that kind of a centralized map drawing.
Well, Chris, you're correct. Things like that have been talked about. And so, Sam?
Well, yeah, Chris raises a good point. So over the last 5 years or so, there's been increasing interest in reining in gerrymandering. It in some ways hit a peak in 2012 when half a dozen states went and did it. But there have been a few attempts. I mentioned before the break that the Supreme Court flirted with it, but then they ended up stepping back. But then the United States Congress tried to do it. And in the House of Representatives, also in the Senate, there was H.R. 1, which came by a few names. One of it was the For the People Act. And the idea there was to establish independent commissions, citizens that would come together like a jury once a decade and have the job of redrawing the lines. Congress has that power under the Constitution to require that. It failed. It was it didn't meet with enough support. Democrats were very strongly in support. Republicans not so much, and a few Democrats objected to it. So it was an attempt. I would say that nationally, the two ways to deal with it with partisan gerrymandering are either through the Supreme Court, if they ever got more sympathetic to voting rights, or Congress, if it could get past its current paralysis. In the meantime, the current solution is to go through the states, and there are a lot of solutions in at least some states to rein in this offense.
Well, think about it. If a member of Congress gets elected via a gerrymandered district, they're not really going to be in favor of trying to vote for a process for drawing fair districts.
That is true. So politicians of both parties have over the years been against reform. So, for instance, there's an independent commission in California that that has the job of drawing the lines. And when it was up for a vote, a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, campaigned for it, and a Democratic leader, Nancy Pelosi, was against it. So certainly politicians like to pick their voters. They don't like it so much when voters pick the politicians. And in a Democratic state like California, then entrenched Democrats might not like it so much. And in a Republican state like Texas, Republican politicians might not like it so much.
So to get there, I would have to imagine a mass people-powered movement demanding something like this and rejecting any politician who won't go along. It's going to take a groundswell to make that happen.
Yeah, there are a few ways to do it, though. I think one thing is that government is complicated, elections are complicated, and voters don't always look in the right place to make a difference just because everyone has their own lives to lead. And so I think that one big place to make progress in the coming years is going to be at the state level. Now that gerrymandering is front and center in people's minds, people can advocate for fairness laws in their own state. In about half the states, they can amend the Constitution themselves and directly take the power from politicians. I think that voters have more ways than we might imagine to make a difference, and Congress isn't the only way. I would say that it's maybe time for voters to discover their inner Federalist.
All right, let's go to the caller. We have Mary. And Mary, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call. Thank you for having such wonderful shows. And I just want to say, you asked the question, are you tired of, you know, this gerrymandering that's happening? And I just wanted to tell you that, yes, I'm tired. And to piggyback on what Chris was saying and the answer to Chris's question, I sure do hope we do get a groundswell that begins so that we can send a message to America that we need to do something. Wake up. And that's all. Thank you.
Well, Mary, thank you for that call. And so, Sam, you've been at this for a while. I guess you've heard that those sentiments from many people across the nation.
Yeah, I think Mary is absolutely correct that many, many people are fed up. It's we live in a time when voters feel that they don't get representation, that their elected officials don't represent them. I think it starts to devolve onto organizations that understand where the levers of power are. In Texas, as far as I can tell, it's super tough to make a difference. The one way I can imagine it happening is maybe the Texas Supreme Court. If that were a pretty different court, you can imagine that being a way that gerrymandering could be reined in. One of the difficulties is that every state's different. So in Texas, there are no laws overseeing congressional redistricting at all. It is truly the Wild West in Texas. And so what you need is, for instance, a court that's willing to find principles in the state constitution of free and fair elections or of equal justice for all voters.
Well, the Texas Supreme Court is an elected body. It's completely made up of people who run on the Republican ticket. And we've seen people like Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick targeting members of the Texas Supreme Court when they don't go along with their plan. So, you know, they'll run TV ads saying that, you know, smearing them and things. So it's a political body as well.
That is certainly the case. State Supreme Court races used to be somewhat sleepy affairs. And it used to be that, I don't know, I'm not really sure the kinds of things that would come up, like real estate deals, I suppose, or what have you. But state Supreme Court races have become more and more important in establishing local rights. I've encountered people who are unaware that their home state has a Supreme Court. But as far as I'm aware, every state has one. And those courts are going to be increasingly important in all kinds of questions, whether it be voting rights, gerrymandering, you know, women's rights, a wide variety of issues are more and more devolving to the states. And you know, Wisconsin was a place where this came up, where Janet Protasiewicz ran for Wisconsin Supreme Court for office, as Texas judges do. And one of her points that she made was that partisan gerrymandering was an offense against voting rights.
Let's go now to another caller. We have Ben, and Ben, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. Well, first off, I'd like to correct you, Mr. Davey. The United States is not a democracy. It is a republic. That is the definition in our Constitution, and it's carried through from the onset. So to call the United States a democracy is wrong. We are a republic with democratic principles in some degree. Secondly, gerrymandering is nothing new. It started in Massachusetts in about the year 1810 or something like that, when a fellow named Jerry decided to make the district to suit himself. Now, you say gerrymandering does not reflect the will of the people, but the lines are drawn by representatives of the people in the legislatures. So you've got a contradiction in terms there.
Okay. Ben, thank you for that. Golly, I'm really sorry that I thought that we were a democracy. So, Sam, you know, I guess I'll just stand in the corner for a while.
Boy. Okay. So this is I've heard all these things at some frequency, and I think there's a little bit of gentle correction that needs to take place. The first thing that's true is that Elbridge Gerry, the governor of Massachusetts, signed in the first gerrymander in 1812. So that part is true. Here are the things that are not true. The United States is absolutely a democracy. It is a democracy in the form of a republic. Every democracy has to have rules of the road, and it so happens that our rules are the Constitution. So our democracy is in the form of a republic where we elect representatives to look out after our interests. So that is just a categorically false statement. In regard to gerrymandering being not the will of the people, there's a technical point here that I think the caller is describing in a way that I would not entirely agree with. It is true that we elect representatives, and it is true that representatives draw those lines. But if those representatives draw the lines so that voters' sentiments don't matter anymore, then the link between voters and their representatives is broken. So it's not like voting for a governor or other statewide office where we have a direct say and voting rights consist of letting us have our say. Because of the fact that we have this weird system where we have districts where we're represented, those districts provide a way for representatives to engage in self-dealing. And I think that's a little bit hard to appreciate, that that line drawing, while technical and obscure, is a critical point in our democracy. And I would say that if the caller were living in a state, I'm going to hazard a guess that he lives in a state where Republicans are in control. If he were in a state where Democrats were in control, such as Illinois, he might not like so much the fact that the dominant party gets to draw itself into power. So, but, you know, I certainly appreciate the sentiments. And I think it just goes to show how important it is for citizens to really understand which levers, when pressed, lead to changes in power.
Let's go to another caller. We have Jennifer. And Jennifer, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for this topic. I'm really interested in demographics, and I've seen party representation change really drastically in my lifetime. Do you feel like this is what the changing demographics are, what is driving this move by the Republicans?
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. And Sam?
Well, let's see. Changing demographics. I will say that one of the big elements that fuels the craze for gerrymandering over the last few decades is that starting in the mid-1990s, the two political parties have drawn farther and farther apart, where the elected officials, the ones who run the party, have very little in common, and it's hard for them to find common ground. And when there's no common ground, there's more and more motivation to just maximize seats and less motivation to work together. So I think that a big fuel in the current gerrymandering wars is that separation between the two parties. And also, part of that separation comes from us, the voters, where we often have very little that we feel that we have in common with the opposing party. And so we become loyal to one political party. Even if we don't like the political party very much, that polarization between the two parties forces us to pick. And we, you know, even if we don't really like either party, we will pick whichever party seems closest to us. And so we're, think of us as a big third mountain of voters separate from the two parties, and we end up picking between these two. So in a way, it's demographics, but it's also that these divides that separate us, Democrats from Republicans, urban from rural, all kinds of divides that make it really tough to have a reasoned democracy.
So the question is, how far could this gerrymandering for political advantage go? And I saw a story about how in California, the reaction from some Republicans is it's time for them to divide the state and have two states. And so then in Texas, there's always talk of dividing Texas into five separate states. And so when you do that, you're actually creating, you know, new, you would have 10 basic senators from the state of Texas. And it sounds far-fetched, and of course it is because it's not happening yet, but you wonder, like, could it get there?
Isn't I believe, if I recall correctly, I am no Texan, but I believe that the original terms of Texas joining the Union were retaining the power to separate into those five states.
Yes.
So now one thing I will say about that is that it sounds like a good idea, and it might be nice to have 10 senators, but one thing I should point out is that those five states would have fixed boundaries, and there would be no opportunity for jiggery-pokery to move those boundaries around. So I would say I kind of am intrigued by the idea, and it might lead to a short-term gain, but it is not at all clear that that would entrench partisan power. You know, I guess five Texases, it seems, it's a little daunting for the rest of us.
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay. I get it. The people outside of Texas look at us with a jaundiced eye frequently. All right. We're going to take a break here. We're going to get some more callers on the air. Annalisa, you will be next. And our phone lines are open. You got a question or comment about the redistricting war, this race to the bottom. What does it mean for our democracy and your voice in government? Call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we will continue our conversation with Sam Wong, director of the Electoral Innovation Lab, the Gerrymandering Lab. He has pioneered innovative ways to measure and analyze gerrymandering. We're going to be talking about the maps that we have here in Texas and how critics say they are illegal and they are racial gerrymandering. What does that mean? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about gerrymandering, political maps that are drawn all squiggly, and they look like salamanders and other strange creatures drawn up in a way so that voting power can be kept in the hands of special interest and dilute the voting power of certain groups. And in Texas, we're critics of the new maps are saying this is racial gerrymandering. The maps bulldoze important minority districts to dilute the ability for black and brown communities to pick their own political representation fairly. So we're getting into that today. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. Speaking with Sam Wong, director of the Electoral Innovation Lab. And let's get to a caller, Annalisa. Annalisa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Okay, so this is my question. So all the lawsuits are based on racial gerrymandering, but I wonder, is there not a cause of action in the deprivation of my right to representation? Like, if I'm having to drive 100, 150 miles to go talk to my representative, how am I actually being represented? And so I feel like, you know, all of these little like spur shape, U shape, J shape districts are a deprivation of actual representation to the persons in those districts.
All right, Annalisa, thank you for that. Doesn't have to be a square. It can look like earmuffs, right?
Sam? Yeah, there's all kinds of shapes. There was a shape in Chicago that, like you say, is shaped like a pair of earmuffs. That was there actually was a good reason for that one, which is that there were Hispanic and black communities living in Chicago. And the only way for Hispanic communities to have any kind of say, I think, on the north and south side of that pair of earmuffs, I think there were some Hispanic communities in the left ear, others in the right ear. And what had to be done was drawn together. I mean, she's got a point, though. One way that maps can be drawn is to have them be kind of janky and have strange shapes that artfully snip out one side's voters or the other. But you can also have a simple shape that just reaches in. Like if you look in the new Texas plan, there's one that that seems to accomplish what it's doing by starting in the eastern parts of Dallas and reaching out to Arkansas and Louisiana and getting most of the way there. And it's just shaped like a tadpole. And the head of the tadpole is over towards Shreveport, I believe. And so you can get three-fourths of the way from Dallas to Shreveport and stay in the same district, the 32nd district. So that's something that's less complicated, but it achieves what Annalisa is saying.
Well, what about the idea that a congressional district should have at least some sort of similar community? It should have people of the similar interest in that district.
Yeah, there are a lot of ideas in voting rights. Annalisa has made an important point, and you've put your finger on something important. Districts, we expect districts to do a lot of jobs. We want them to carry out the task of representing our cities, our counties, our communities. And in voting rights law, there's a concept called communities of interest, where a group of people that have shared interests, whether it's farming or language or religion or whatever it may be that has legislative consequences, those people have a right to be represented. And as long as we stick with a district-based system, we are asking districts to do a lot of tasks. And she's right. They, voters should have a right to do that. It so happens that the Supreme Court's not terribly friendly to that at the moment. And so we have to start looking in state constitutions and state laws to start providing that kind of protection for our communities.
Let's go to Sean on the phone. Sean, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I know the county I live in. I know the precinct I live in. And right across the street from me is a constable in my precinct. And a great neighbor, great friend. Now, if they precisely and incisely draw these lines, is there a chance that he is no longer going to be someone that I can vote for? And am I going to have to go someplace else to vote?
So, okay, Sean. So it looks like, I mean, they're able to really dial in nowadays with computers and really cut out people and houses and blocks just based upon their voting record, aren't they?
Yeah. Voter habits are sufficiently habitual and predictable that precinct by precinct voting is a record that's available. Anyone with desktop software can then take those and draw maps to their heart's content. And he is correct that it is possible that he will be in a different district from across the street from him. I believe this new map that's about to go into effect for the 2026 election in Texas displaces about 32-33% of Texas voters into a different district. And so one out of three Texans will be living in a different congressional district than the one they thought they were in. And it is using voters as raw material to serve the interests of politicians.
What do you think that means that so many people in Texas, what was the statistic you gave again? And what does that mean that so many people are now in a different congressional district?
Well, for instance, one thing it means is that that if you thought that your representative was, say, Mr. Cuellar or Mr. Gonzalez near the southern border, you might find that actually their constituents now reach hundreds of miles closer. I believe that Henry Cuellar's district now reaches nearly all the way to San Antonio. And so people get moved around. There's now a district that starts from Amarillo, right? So up top in the very northern part of the state, and goes nearly all the way to Tarrant County. And so these are districts where, as I believe Annalisa said, they will have to drive hundreds of miles to meet their congressman, and their congressman will have to travel hundreds of miles to go see them.
Well, I mean, just so put on your neuroscientist cap and talk about identity and things like that for a second. And again, what was the statistic? Because it went by so fast.
Oh, well, one in three Texans are going to be in the new district.
One in three.
Yeah.
Okay. And what does that mean when you say like so many people? Will this be a kind of way to maybe discourage people from participating in elections?
Well, one thing that's true is that we look ancestrally way back when districts were concocted back in Old England. The ideal was there should be territorial integrity, that a district should be reasonably compact. But these districts are often not compact. And so it's really hard for us to feel represented when the people who are represented by a single district live so far apart from one another. And that's why compactness is an old principle that comes up. And so one thing I think that we look for is that kind of compactness. Is that what you're looking after?
Just I think that if I'm a guy and I've always voted for in the 20th congressional district, my parents have and my cousins and everybody have, suddenly I find myself in a different district and I don't really feel connected to that district and that person from Congress. And I just basically kind of feel like, why even vote?
Yeah, this is really tough. So it's already hard to build competition in the American system because rural and urban voters have separated from one another so strongly. On the one side, mostly preferring Republicans. On the other side, mostly preferring Democrats. And so that's already difficult. I think there are lots of reasons to vote still. One thing that's interesting about Texas is that voters do not register by party. And what that means is that anybody can walk in and request a ballot for either the Democratic Party or the Republican primary. And so one possibility, say in Texas, for example, is the primary election, where that is still going to be a competitive election in many, many districts, whether for Congress or for 150 seats in the state house. That's an opportunity for voters to engage. Seems a little bit less exciting to vote in a primary than a general election.
Well, that's mistaken. Because in Texas, whoever wins the Republican primary basically wins the election.
Well, then maybe people should vote in the Republican primary.
Yeah, and vote in with in good faith, voting for this person.
What I mean is, what I mean is there's a dominant party, and in every district there is one primary that matters. And when you go to that primary, and yeah, it would be better to do it in good faith, but the thing is, I think anybody living in a district has some interest in making sure that somebody reasonable represents them. And so I agree with you that people should not vote frivolously. But it is true that if there's a competitive election in your district, then, you know, you might want to take a good hard look at the candidates who are available and see whether you have a preference among them.
Let's go to Joe on the phones. And Joe, you have the floor.
Yes, hi. A quick comment about the redistricting in general. Whether Republican or Democrat, the parties have gotten so scientific, as you said earlier, they can fine-tune it down to a dog and a cat. Problem is that it is so fine-tuned that the politicians running in these districts have been able to completely dominate their district. In other words, they don't have to worry about the opposing party running against them because their district has practically been guaranteed to them. So therefore, they have no fear of getting voted out of office. This is one reason we keep getting politicians get revoted in. Year after year, they end up 30 years. The only people they are accountable to are special interests. That was just basically my comment. Thank you.
All right, Joe. Well, you bring up that point again about the primary. You know, if you're a Democrat, you worry about your left flank. And if you're a Republican, you worry about your right flank.
Yeah, although, you know, in this current map, they may have cut it kind of close. It is true that many voters are quite habitual, but Hispanic communities in Texas have been swinging. And they swung towards Trump in 2024. They might stay there or they might swing back. And I would say that there are still opportunities, more than you might imagine, in the Texas congressional map. And so the big question mark, I think, next year is whether the legislators got a little too smart by half.
Yeah.
There's a saying, pigs get fat, but hogs get slaughtered. And I do wonder whether maybe they pushed a little too far this time. So I he's got a point, but I think that there are some opportunities to express one's anger next year.
Let's go now to a break. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And our conversation with Sam Wong will continue after this one-minute break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about gerrymandering, redistricting, voting, all these things. They impact you. Public policy directly impacts your life, and you have to really participate or else you're just going to get overlooked. We're speaking with Sam Wong. He is the director of the Electoral Innovation Lab. I want to talk more about the maps that we have now in Texas. It's on Governor Abbott's desk. I'm sure he's going to sign it. This is the map that Donald Trump ordered Texas to deliver. Donald Trump said he deserved 5 new seats, Republican seats from Texas, and that this is something that he thought would help him maintain control over Congress. However, the rationale that was given by Governor Greg Abbott, he called the special session and saying that lawmakers needed to redraw the maps because he got a letter from the Justice Department saying that the maps that we now have are unconstitutional because race was considered in the drawing of them. And now we have these new maps, and the Texas NAACP is saying these are even more racially gerrymandered, that they will obliterate majority-minority districts and dilute the ability of black and brown communities to pick their political representation fairly. So, Sam Wong, what is it about maps? Why do we have this whole question about drawing maps that do reflect the will of communities of color?
The difficulty with these maps, with any maps, is that when people choose to live in various patterns, then the challenge is how to make sure that the different communities get represented. The Department of Justice has increasingly, I think it's become clear in the last few months, gotten into this weird place where it's directly performing as an instrument of the president's personal preferences. That's not supposed to happen in the administration of justice. And now, so right now, this new map removes districts that did exist that provided opportunities for Black and Hispanic voters to elect members of their choice in parts of Dallas, in parts of Houston, in parts of San Antonio. And those maps are almost certainly going to hit a court challenge, but they're going to hit a court challenge where the federal courts have been increasingly hostile towards the idea of using lines to represent different communities in this manner. And so we're at a turning point, I think, in voting rights, where a lot of these ideas are ending up being, you know, much less stable than we ever imagined growing up in our lifetimes.
Looking at it from a cynic's point of view, it seems like, you know, the Supreme Court and all these other courts, that they are become partisan and that they will judge these, and they're coming up with these decisions and obliterating the idea that communities of color should have a voice in government. You know, and they want to prop up the Republican Party simply because they're all, you know, politically aligned. Is that it's being too cynical to think that?
It's really unfortunate to watch courts get this way. I will say that there used to be a lot of ideas about what courts ought to do. I think for much of our lifetimes, the idea was something like courts should be restrained and not change the law too much and not change too much policy too much. But historically, over the last several hundred years, the party that's been less dominant in courts has wanted more restraint. And the party that's been more dominant in courts has wanted a more creative approach. And I think we've seen this pendulum swing back. There's a law scholar named Jack Balkin who wrote a really great book called Cycles of Constitutional Time, where he basically predicted that the conservative wings of courts, mostly federal courts, are going to get more assertive about their ideas of what the law ought to be. And so we're at a turning point. I think a big challenge over the next decades in our country is going to be how to get back to a point where both courts and legislators represent what people want. And it is distressing to see courts become instruments of partisan warfare.
Let's go to Randall on the phones. And Randall, you're on the air.
Another hot take for you. I vote in the Republican primary and then vote Democrat in the general. I've been doing that for 20 years because at least that way, since I'm going to get stuck with a Republican, at least I have a small say in that. It worked in 2018 when I was living in Kansas. Democrats voted in the Republican primary and helped push extremist Chris Kobach up against Democrat Laura Kelly. Laura Kelly is now approaching the end of her second term as governor. And it worked last year here in Texas when my vote helped defeat extremist Brandon Herrera when he was in the runoff against Tony Gonzalez. And as you may have heard, Brandon Herrera was praised by yesterday's school shooter up in Minnesota. So I'm not going to say it, but we dodged something, I think, when we voted Brandon Herrera out or avoided that. There's a euphemism I'm not going to use. But, yeah, vote in the Republican primary because at least you have a sense in that. And then you can vote Democrat in the general.
I think it was just a couple of hundred votes that separated Brandon Herrera from Tony Gonzalez.
And it was very close.
And
yeah.
So I think that when you go to vote, you should be voting in good faith and voting for the best candidate sincerely, even if you're crossing party lines to vote in the Republican primary. It used to be back in the day when there was basically one party rule of Democrats in Texas where everyone voted in the Democratic primary and then they voted their own way in the general election. But, I mean, is that so unheard of, Sam Wang?
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting is that we get forced into these stances by voting rules that force us to pick candidates first in a party primary for just one party, and then the only choices we have available at the time of the general election are you know, one nominee from each party. So I do elections research at Princeton University, and we've been looking at election rules, and we've been looking both at real elections and also doing computer simulations. And there's an idea that could work better, which is to have everybody run in one big primary and then have the top, whatever, two or three finishers go on to the general election and then make your choice then. And that allows the caller to have his say over whatever candidate he wants from any party, and then allows him to be able to vote sincerely there and vote sincerely in November. So at some level, we are trapped by this system that used to work better when parties weren't so far apart from one another, where party primaries were a way for us to deliberate and come up with each party's best foot forward. But we have gotten into a place where it might be a good idea to rethink that and think about ways to allow the caller to have his say in a more sincere manner without having to be forced into a party primary.
California Democrats are saying they're fighting fire with fire as they do their own gerrymandering to come up with seats to counter the Texas gerrymandering. The problem with fire with fire is pretty certain you're burning everything down to the ground. But you can kind of see where they're coming from. But can this fire get out of control?
It certainly could. The biggest sources of fire are currently Texas with 3 to 5 seats on one side, California with, in our estimation at the Electoral Innovation Lab, 4 or 5 seats on the other side. Most other places are not going to have a lot of seats. And so I would say typical change against the incumbent president in the House is 13 seats. The last time Trump was president, 14 seats switched. And so I would say Texas and California might make a big difference. But, you know, all these other little sub-fires are just one seat here, one seat there. And before any legislator thinks about getting funny with mid-decade redistricting, they might want to think about whether it is really worth the candle, I guess, to go upending the map for all their citizens.
We were talking about North Carolina earlier. It does seem like there could be some sort of change that would force another redrawing of North Carolina's maps to move things back. Is that possible?
Maybe. I think one thing that is probably the biggest thing on the table in North Carolina is court elections, where people in North Carolina have to think about whether they really want this kind of perpetual warfare. And I think that the North Carolina Supreme Court, which has flipped once, could flip back. I have not heard reports of the legislature wanting to redraw the congressional map, but I think that the battle for fairness in North Carolina is very much going to be played out in state courts.
And Moore versus Harper, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case over whether the state courts can override partisan drawn maps, a ruling that could drastically reshape election oversight in North Carolina and beyond. So we should be watching Moore v. Harper.
Oh, yes.
And so the question is, like, what impact does this have on the faith that people have in their democracy?
I think it's fair for people to feel unrepresented. As I said before, many of us are in this third mountain where we don't feel fully represented by Democrats or by Republicans. I think a lot of the disruption to our democracy over the last years and accelerating the last 6 months, you know, the optimist in me says that this is focusing people on how their democracy works and doesn't. In the coming years, I'm hoping that that we can get to a point where we can take a look after some of these things have either gotten worse or created open ground for us to start rebuilding our democracy. And, you know, that's pretty idealistic because it's a pretty tough time for democracy right now. But I think it's a good time for us to think about what kind of democracy we really want.
But you are basically an optimist. I hear optimism in your voice. And, you know, and I cherish that. I welcome that. And I wonder about it. Talk about, where does that optimism come from? You've been studying this for a long time. You know this in great detail. Do you still see that we can, our better angels can step forward?
There are tools that we have not started using as Americans. One tool is local governance, whether it be local voting rules, ranked choice voting in city races or in town races, state laws and state courts. And what I would like to believe is that because those are underused tools, that we can start using those tools. Whether we will get more sanity in our federal government is going to depend in part on having rules that allow people to cross party lines when they vote in primaries and so on. So it is, I am not doubting that it is a very hard time right now for our democracy, but I'm just pointing out that there's a lot that can be done when people look to their communities, look to their states, you know, look forward.
And we've had tough times before and have figured out a way out of it and become a functioning democracy.
The first Gilded Age gave way to the progressive era when women got the vote, when senators became elected by direct election. And in my view, the voting patterns seem to match us being in a second Gilded Age now. And if you were in the middle of the first Gilded Age, it wasn't so clear that something better was coming. And
right.
So though it's a dark time now, but
you'll get
you
there.
Know,
Sam Wong, maybe. Director of the Electoral Innovation Lab, thank you so much. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Thank you.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.